to get to know him early when I was there in 1955, because Don was working in the research department, working for Bounty, and he was interested in this pusher thing, and so I got a little bit acquainted with him. Good time.
You've already mentioned and your the reluctance of your boss when you said you wanted to go sell chemicals. Now, let me back up one more moment.
Sure.
Yeah, you came in with an ag background, but you didn't stay in ag very long.
That's true. The Aggies, I wanted the Aggies more than they needed me.
Okay. And how did you feel about that?
Okay, because for two reasons. First, this polymer business was a chance to get right back to the West Coast, which I was kind of looking for. And B, that was a pretty interesting area in chemistry, and these were romance projects, and everybody's paying a lot of attention to them, so I thought, well, there'll be another time for ag. And there was, 30-some years later. But,
yes.
But it didn't bother me.
Okay.
Not a problem.
What possessed you to say all of a sudden, I guess you'd been 5 years doing research in the research area, I want to go sell chemicals rather than do research?
I guess, Jim, I didn't believe that I would advance to the senior levels of Dow's research organization. And I don't want you to misunderstand that. It wasn't that I had some goal in my life then to become president of something, because I really never had, never ever had that kind of objective. But I wanted to do well and, you know, achieve things and be personally satisfied. And while I was doing good work, I think, in the research area, I watched a lot of other folks. I came in contact with a lot of Dow's marketing and TS&D people. And I envied their chance to get acquainted with people outside the company and see what's going on in other places and do other things. I was so naive at the time that I thought, well, the best way to learn that is to go out and be a field seller somewhere. And what I really wanted to do was be in what we call TS&D, Technical Service and Development. Development's always the thing that has charged my batteries the most. But I was having trouble getting to that from research. So the selling thing was, I just wanted to find out for myself whether I had the ability to interact with people and whether I had the kind of skill set that it took to be really good in it. Because I knew I was doing okay in the chemistry, but I wasn't going to be probably a world beater. And I just got curious. I just wanted to go find out. About that simple.
But apparently your research had been pretty good because they didn't want you to go.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know how good the research was. It was certainly true they didn't think much of my going. I mean, I contributed a lot to this project. It was getting off the ground. And that got to be a little battle of wills then, as you can see from what I said with my boss, that I don't know, you can't go. And I said, wait a minute, I've already decided I'm going. It's a question of with who, and, you know, that gets to be kind of... I liked that fellow very much. I was named Dave Pye. He was a terrific guy. But I called his bluff. He called my bluff, and then I called his. And neither of us blinked, kind of. So off I went to Shell to sell ammonia.
How did you make the contact with Shell?
I don't remember. I don't remember with certainty. My dad was at something called the Pendleton Grain Growers up there in eastern Oregon, and that was Shell, maybe largest, but one of Shell's largest ammonia dealers. And it's possible that it was through that. I might have just written them, because they were just down the road from Pittsburgh. They were out there fairly close. And I might have just written them a letter. I'm embarrassed to say I don't exactly remember.
And how did you feel selling?
Enjoyed that a lot. You know, it was total. I mean, I moved from this white lab coat out there in a manufacturing plant to a desk in the heart of downtown San Francisco on 100 Bush Street on, I think, the ninth floor. you couldn't hardly get more downtown than that. And I don't believe I would have been happy doing that for a long time. But the change was so great, and the opportunity to interact with people. And yeah, I'm just a phone chemical salesperson, but I'm scheduling rail cars and trying to find better ways to get cheaper freight rates, doing a whole lot of stuff that I didn't even know existed in the world, and I enjoyed that for the time I did it, which was only 18 months or so. It was a very good experience. As I told Ned and have said many times, the two best professional things I ever did in my life were leave Dow and come back.
And as I understand it, Dow called you.
Yeah, that's true. What had happened there is that a bunch of patents had started to develop from the work I'd done before. And they had decided to take this show on the road, if you will. So they kind of come back and said, gee, we think you might like to be in the technical service and development function, developing this thing that you know more about than anybody else. So we're going to offer you this job in PS&D to go do that. I mean, you know, if I'd written the job description before I left of what I wanted to do, that was kind of it. So I'd kind of done this other thing for 18 months. I knew how to do rail cars, and I mean, I kind of had that. I'd satisfied myself, yeah, I can do that. So it was perfect. Perfect.
Somebody up there knew what you wanted.
Yeah, I guess. Oh, yeah. There was somewhere there was some divine guidance. It wasn't great skill on my part. I was just lucky.
So that was 62 when you
right.
went back.
Exactly right.
And, gee, you were there 5 years with the, still working on the Pusher project.
Yeah, I was, you know, that was the 5 years in which we went to every major oil company in the country and said, here's a good deal for you, why don't you sign up? A lot of them didn't sign up, but some of them did sign up. And so that was a busy 5 years. You're right. From then, 5 years there and then off to Houston.
Were you more involved in the sales aspect of that as opposed to the development aspect?
If you're thinking of development in the sense of research or chemistry, I was more involved in the selling of the process.
Okay.
And the technology, then developing the technology. But a lot of what was going on then were actual field experiments with these companies. I mean, we'd be out on some big oil field somewhere. As for example, in the Queeley Dome field in Wyoming in the middle of the dang winter, sitting on a wellhead putting this polymer in the ground and hoping a lot of oil came out the other end. I did a lot of that.
Okay.
So in that sense, development of the process and getting it sold was the combination. I'd convince somebody we ought to go try this in their field, and then I'd be the guy who got to go out and try it in their field.
Was it a relief when it worked? I mean, were there times when you did this and it didn't work?
Yeah, you know, work gets to be one of these definition things in that process. The idea was you're thickening up this water, it'll get more efficient than pushing oil out. That always worked, I think, basically. But because the water was thicker, you had to push harder on it or it didn't go as fast. And even though it was more efficient, it didn't get more barrels out the back end because it was harder to push. If you, you know, and all these oil guys care about is how much oil comes out the end. Well, efficiency, the hell with that. That's 10 years down the road, that extra oil. We're talking now. So sometimes that didn't work. But it was a peculiar thing, and I'm sure, I mean, I must have mentioned this to Ned, that was a time, particularly in Texas, where they had restrictions on the wells, what they called allowable amounts that wells could produce. If you went to the commission and proved that you were using an efficiency-improving process, they'd raise the amount that they let the wells produce. So, I mean,
that was a perfect deal for them. They'd go to the commission and say, we're using this new process, which is going to get more efficient. But of course, it's expensive because we've got to buy all this chemical. So you got to let us increase the production so we can pay for it. Well, that was a good deal. Because then they had the money to pay for it right up front. And they knew they were going to get more at the end. And everybody's pleased with it. You know. So it wasn't that the process got you more oil at the front. It was that the commission let you pump more oil at the front. And then you got more later. It was very interesting.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was kind of an unusual deal. But I remember going in front of the Railroad Commission and testifying that, yes, they are using this stuff, and yes, here's the technical, here's the little work and all that. So we sold a lot of that stuff to get some allowables raised, I'm afraid.
When you're doing something like that, how much proprietary interest is there in the technology? How much can you reveal and not reveal?
Yeah, we were pretty careful about that because we wanted that stuff injected in all the inert environment. And there were things we did with the polymer that kept it from adhering to the clay and the field so that it wouldn't get lost and hung up as it went through. That was fairly proprietary stuff. We were pretty careful with it. We had a long lead on anybody else at that point in time. We kind of wanted to retain it. And we had some pretty solid patent positions. But proprietary technology was an important part of that.
Let's see, you were in Houston then.
Right.
67, I think you went to Houston.
Right, I remember it because it's the year the Astrodome opened.
Oh, okay. It's too bad they're not playing baseball in it anymore.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, that's kind of that thing you mentioned about how many people were on the Mayflower. It's kind of like how many people saw the basketball game between Houston and UCLA when Houston had
yes.
Elvin Hayes and UCLA had Al Cinder.
Right.
I think it was still the most watched college basketball game ever. And probably 8 million people were in that little stadium, but I was one of them.
Really?
I did go to that game. Yeah.
Marvelous.
I was on that Mayflower.
Marvelous. This was SWRD, I think, the Secondary
right.
Oil Recovery Department,
right.
which you closed down.
Yes, sir, I did.
Was that your idea, or were you given orders to do that?
I was given orders to stop the research activity in the Western Division. That's what I shut down. That's the research in where I'd started back in the mid-50s. My instructions were to gracefully phase that out. I mean, gracefully in the sense of managing employees properly. And the reason for that was we decided to transfer that technology and the activity to Dow Well.
Okay.
Which is where it belonged, basically. If it belonged anywhere, it belonged there more. So my job was to go back to my old starting point and make it disappear. Not a particularly pleasant assignment, but one that I think we got done okay.
This wasn't the last time you were going to be doing something
That's
like
true.
This.
That is true.
And of course, it really tests one's ability in managing people when you're given that kind of an assignment.
It does indeed.
But it's looking at an overall research management aspect. Is there this? Research changes as time goes on, and so you've got to look at how you can consolidate and best manage your resources. How do you make those kinds of decisions? Is it a business decision? Is it a bottom line decision to say, all right, this research group's got to be phased out?
Yeah, ultimately it is. In the purest sense, I guess, bottom line, you kind of say, I say kind of three things. How productive is this area likely to be in terms of value? How expensive is it likely to be in terms of cost? And what are my alternative uses of those resources? And if I can get that figured out, I can tell you what to do with that project.
Mm-hmm.
I can be wrong about my guesses on any of those things. But I mean, somebody's got to judge. And I mean, that's kind of what it amounts to. And that, one of the problems, of course, with research is being dispassionate about it. When you get into a project and it's yours and you want to make it go and you're the project champion, better there be somebody somewhere who's kind of dispassionate and has to pick between those. I don't believe that's... I can't speak outside of the Dow world much. But to the extent I have any sense at all, I don't think that's particularly well done by industrial chemical concerns today. I don't think that's done thoughtfully enough. I think there tends to be more focus on the trees and not enough on the forest, I will say to you. Everybody puts together what we used to call swag sheets. You know, scientific wild-ass guess sheets about what we're going to about two of those three things at least, not usually the alternative, the first two. And the focus was always more on getting those in and getting the ritual done than standing back and really saying, wait, we're going to use 30 people on this for 3 years, and nobody can, this is going to make synthetic earwax, for crying out loud. Nobody's going to buy synthetic earwax. And we got too much earwax. You know, or eyebrows on frogs or whatever. That wasn't done rigorously. It may be today, but it was not done rigorously enough during the time I was involved in. My view.
For lack of any other word, several people have told me as we were looking at the factors that are involved in decision making, that one factor, not the only one, but one factor ends up being instinct. You can make all of these judgments you can put on paper, but somewhere along the line there's some instinct that you can't define that plays some kind of role. Did you experience anything like
yes,
that?
Yes, and I would agree with that, at least in part, maybe dissent in part. Instinct can be based on, at least historical information and experience. I mean, instinct isn't something you're necessarily born with. So you get into a little semantic thing about what's instinctive and what comes from what you know, your knowledge of the people involved, your sense of the kind of the broad parameters that are driving society in a particular direction. Are we really going to need advanced plastic materials like everything? You know, all of those things become part of what folks call instinct. But in the sense you don't have any good numbers or anything, and you got to make your best guess, and that I will accept as instinct. What I prize most highly, and if you were to ask Orifus, he would tell you, I, for some reason, happen to possess in abundance, or at least he keeps telling people I do, is not maybe instinct, but common sense. And I think those two things either intertwine or kind of need to go hand in hand. I mean, it's a little like playing poker. Your instinct might say, I think he's bluffing, I'm going to bet everything. Your common sense might say, I think he's bluffing, but I can find that out for one more dollar and save all my money for the next hand. You know, all I got to do is call him now. I don't have to put it all in there because I think he's bluffing. Well, maybe that's a silly, semantic way to show the difference between instinct and common sense. I think both are pretty handy. But I would agree that instinct is part of effective research management. For that matter, effective general management. Not just management of research development or project priorities, but a lot of other public perception, which I've spent a lot of my career doing, involves some instinct for what you think the reactions are going to be. It's a little like that.
Yes, you touched on this just before. You have this possibility, in, especially in research, of little fiefdoms growing up. And everybody's out there selling their idea to management instead of looking at how all of this interacts. And was that a problem at Dow?
You bet.
Part of human nature, I guess.
There was a part of human nature. Now, you know, Dow in the 50s and 60s, in a sense, turned that to advantage by letting those fiefdoms compete one with the other on the same project. I'm sure you've heard about that from Pruitt and Martin. All these guys will tell you kind of how that was done. I suspect that was productive. And I mean, from the shareholders, I will tell you that it could be a little languishing on the interpersonal relationships. But that's what they did. They said, yeah, we get fiefdoms. Let's give them the same project and one will win. And that is a way to deal with fiefdomism instead of having everybody have a different one and do it, you know. So, yeah, I it's a balanced deal. You can't have fiefdoms. I mean, another example of that, as the world becomes smaller and more enterprises have to think in a global context. And I'll use agriculture as an example. You know, you got your European ag company and your U.S. ag company, you're a big company and you got all these geographies around. And here's a compound that is, let me use a hypothetical example, really good on the weed spectrum in Europe. Maybe your second best compound in the U.S. spectrum, and maybe really good in Latin America, let's say. Well, the U.S. doesn't want you to develop that compound, because for the U.S., they got another one that is really good. The practical problem is you don't have enough resources to develop two compounds. So somebody's got to make a judgment about which one you're going to do. And if you had all fiefdoms autonomous, you'd be doing two even though you couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's the kind of thing that has put an extra dimension on research management. I could make some general management scenarios with the same kind of thing. But it gets more complex now as we're trying to do global models of things. That wasn't true in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
It's true today.
Well, in a similar context, there's a story I remember from, I think it was Willard, some researchers went to Willard Dow and they said, Willard, we've got this process, we want you to support this group. And we know it will work because it's the way DuPont does it. And Willard said to them, if we can't do it better and differently than DuPont, we're not going to do it.
Yeah. I mean, who knows whether that really quite happened that way.
Right.
Those are the great lore stories. And we got to do it better and cheaper. That's kind of one of the old songs. Dow has ridden that horse a long way, and it's still kind of a touchstone. But better, let's say, when you get global, I mean, different areas are different enough that the same thing can't always be better in different places, particularly in biological molecules. I mean, weeds are just plain different. You know. Maybe humans and pharmaceuticals are somewhat that way, too.
After you took care of Seward, you went back to Midland.
Right.
And that's when you were involved in process chemicals.
Right.
And I pulled out a quote from your discussion with Ned that I wanted to follow up on. Your your boss there was Lewis
Carmouche.
And you said he wanted the department to be the best, wanted to try creative and new and unconventional things.
That was Louie.
Could you expand on that a little
bit? Yeah, Louie was, I mean, Louie had us do everything from, man, I can't remember all this. Louie was willing to
test concepts. He had a department that was more open to that, but Louis would take a flyer on some novel idea further than any other department general manager. If he thought that, I can remember us working on everything from Indian baskets to camouflage for military application to propellants for airbag devices. I mean, all these just really unusual kinds of activities. And Louis loved those and embraced them and nurtured them and would unload them when they didn't play. I mean, he had the ability to say, okay, we tried that, now we go to the next. But nobody minded because there were always so many. Mm-hmm. And he was very fertile. I mean, we did stuff in his department. We built these great big domes over sewage treatment plants, and we got ourselves in a little trouble here and there with some of that stuff. But he was a creative fellow and loved that.
And did that permeate throughout the group then?
Yeah, it kind of did. We were all frontiers persons with Louis at the helm.
He almost sounds like a reincarnation of John Deasy.
Louis wasn't a researcher. He was a manufacturing guy by training. But if Louis had been in research, that'd have been Grevy again.
Mm-hmm.
Sure would have been.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.